Welcome to Escapist Podcast Volume 2. Welcome, friends. Welcome all. Welcome to our podcast. We're here for you to bring you to the promised land of whatever this is. I'm Russ Pitts, editor-in-chief of Escapist Magazine, Volume 2, and your host, at least in theory. I'm like a figurehead host of this, really. Just sort of wheel me in, and I do this part, and then and then I just sort of like drift off and get bored, and I'll be over here playing.
You're the Queen Elizabeth of the Escapist Podcast Volume 2? Hello!
I'm the crown of the Escapist Podcast Volume 2. I'll just sit here staring disapprovingly the entire time with a little wave, a little smirk. Also joining us, managing editor and what's the term? The prime minister of Escapist Podcast Volume 2, Anthony Agnew.
Yeah, I am the Theresa May of the Escapist Podcast. Everybody likes my plans. Tight.
Yeah.
You can fail a plan so spectacularly and yet keep your position because literally no one else wants it.
Oh, damn it, that's spot on.
Senior editor and sergeant at arms, Sam Nelson. Ooh, how you doing, Sam?
I like it.
Yeah, it's good.
I'm doing well. I like to think of myself as, what's the name of the guy who's the sergeant at arms in Sons of Anarchy, who's like a total stone cold psychopath?
I've never seen it, but I think it fits.
All right.
Yeah, it's good for you. Special guest out in the fourth seat this week, we have movie critic, author, overthinker, Mr. Bob Chipman.
Hi, guys.
Yeah. Bob. What is Bob's official title in our anarchy in the UK hierarchy of this podcast?
Special counsel Bob Chipman.
No.
Bob Chipman conducting the investigation into improper podcast running or something.
I was gonna go with Q at MI6.
That's, I like that too.
That's a good one. Yeah. Q at MI6. What do you got? What do you got in the way of gimmicks and trinkets for us today, Bob?
I have a spoon.
What does it do? Is it doing anything? Shoot lasers? They like, you know, does it turn into an airplane?
Does it have like really special eye gouging properties?
It digs food. Digs food.
Yeah, you can eat Cocoa Puffs with it.
Yeah,
that's the special skill.
Maybe cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. I'm gonna have to give up this app at some point. It's just too, I don't know, but I can't. It's just too awesome.
Yeah, we got it. We need that.
Like and subscribe on the Escapist Podcast Volume 2, everybody. Oh, wow. I totally set the wrong thing. What is that even? Who is that guy?
That sounds like a sheep dying.
Yeah.
That's what that sounds like.
That's horrible. Like
an angry goat.
An angry. Now my dog over here is like, is a sheep dying? No, it's not. No sheep dying. It's okay, girl. How is everybody? How are we doing? It's a week.
Doing well.
Been a week. Yeah.
Yeah, no. January, we wrote it out. We're recording this on February 1st. I think everybody has regained a modicum of soul. Sam Nelson is in the core of the frozen tundra. Sam, can you go outside without crawling inside of a tauntaun at this point?
I can. I was finally able to take my dog for a walk this morning, and she was so relieved. She let out the most giant poop because she'd been clearly just holding it in for like 36 hours. Like, I'd open the door, and she'd be like, no. Mm-mm, no.
I admire dogs and their ability to just nope out on that, you know?
Right? It's like, I wouldn't be able to. So it's sunny. It's like 20 degrees and that feels downright balmy
nice.
Since that's like a 40 degree shift from yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to keep this on too scatological a train, but we only got down to about -12 here in upstate New York. And that was enough for all of the toilets and bathroom sinks in my home to freeze.
Yeah. Oh no.
There has not been an actual place to use the facilities. I at one point yesterday thought to myself, this is what it's like to like live in a fantasy novel. No one can ever go to the bathroom. It's not relevant to the narrative.
You're tugging your braids.
You're just stuck.
So I don't know if I want to know the answer to this, but what, where, how?
Do you want the reality of what's happening in my home?
Can you just give us the capsule version?
All right. I'm going to give you the capsule version. The house that I live in was built in 1940, and it follows like just leaving the Depression era rules, which means the construction is bananas and shoddy and kind of crap. There is, at this moment, a freestanding propane heater propped up in my garage, which is really just a hobbit hole. To call it a garage is like putting on airs. Bilbo Baggins would live in there and be like, cozy. So there's a propane heater in there angled at a single pipe to make the water that is supposed to be coming from the toilet upstairs thaw. It is working for now. The downstairs bathroom, and I only know this because the original tenant, a child that grew up in this home, you know, 70 years ago, stopped by one day to just be like, hey, I grew up here. Do you mind if I come in? I was like, yes, please come in, crazy old man. Let's do this.
Can you explain these claw marks in the closet in this particular room with a lock on it? Can you explain
that?
Yeah.
Here is, Russ, this is verbatim what this man said to me about our downstairs bathroom. Now follow, unbroken sentence. Oh, wow. That's a bathroom. Why would you make that a bathroom? That was our sewing room. It's uninsulated. Why would you have a bathroom there? I was shot through that window. Unbroken. Unbroken.
Who shot him? Who shot him in the sewing room?
My immediate question is, why were you shot through that window? And he goes, oh, well, that field over there where there's now like a building that is senior housing used to just be an open farm field that was infested with rats, and the farmer would go with a .22 and just shoot at rats like Luke Skywalker bullseyeing womp rats in a speeder style. And this dude was shot in the head through his sewing room, which is now my bathroom, that remains 70 years later uninsulated. And so in the winter, you go in, and it's like, ah, I have an indoor outhouse. This is lovely. But the toilet consistently freezes in there.
Wow.
And you can get shot. Yeah, which is a bonus.
Yeah, probably not so much now, hopefully.
Yep. Yeah. So just like a drive-by from a farmer shooting womp rats. That's life. That's life. And the Albany burbs.
That's life in Syracuse.
Yeah, Syracuse. It's all upstate to me.
Russ, let's talk about shooting rats.
Whoa. Oh, so that was nice. That was a nice segue.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was well done, Prime Minister.
I felt it.
Yeah, thank you. No vote of no confidence here.
Yes, Chancellor Valorum. That stealth Phantom Menace drop almost ruined us.
I'm like, I just gave Anthony a compliment. I'm safe to get a sip of coffee. Nope.
Broken. Nope. All right, broken. Russ, you subjected yourself to Anthem. You did it. You went in there.
For science. I did it for the benefit of mankind. Well, somebody's gotta. Given that we're a video game media entity of sorts, and it was there, and I wanted to have the VIP experience, right?
Yeah.
I was a little shocked.
Did you feel very important?
I'll get there. I was a little shocked that my invitation to the VIP experience didn't just show up, right? I was a little shocked that a black panel van didn't pull up to my house and someone from EA pop out with an envelope in their hands and knock on my door with a white glove and hand that to me. A little shocked that didn't happen. So I put down the money, pre-ordered, right? So now we're in the territory of, I'm a consumer. Right?
This is transactional.
Yeah. I've been pulled into this by the marketing, right? I'm like, I want this VIP demo experience. And I'm going to pay for that VIP. Clearly not a VIP, but I'm going to pay to be. It's like paying for the first class upgrade. And then you walk in like everybody else, like, hey, man. Stand right up at front, you know, before the boarding has even started. Just plant your ass right there. It's like, look at me. I'm first class.
Yeah, but Russ, in this case, the velvet rope that's being listed is forcing you to sign into Origin twice.
and there's no free champagne, I'm guessing.
Yeah, there's no free champagne. Yeah, and so we'll just start with the sort of introductory experience of the VIP demo. The game doesn't load. That's part of it. I think I shared pictures on Twitter. There's what they call the 95% bug that apparently affects many users, but not enough for them to fix it during the demo. It loads, the load screen takes forever. And then you're watching that bar. And it's a tiny little thin bar across the top of the screen. And it's moving and it's moving and it's moving and it's moving. And then it stops. And then it stops. And then it stops. And it's just there. And it'll go as long as you let it, man. And then the game won't load. But you can stare at it for half an hour, and that's the VIP experience. So you restart the game, and then you start up, and then it's fine. I don't know. Other than that, there's some issues with the game not actually working, crashing a bit.
Can you tell me, like, ostensibly what you do in Anthem? I swear to God, I think I have watched over 90 minutes of Electronic Arts executives jawing at me about what this game actually is, and I didn't ever get past, like, so everyone's Iron Man?
Yeah. You know, here's the thing, though. This is what I think the demos and all the jawing has failed to encapsulate. It's fun. There's some fun there. It very much reminds me of that first demo we got from... who was it? Secret Level? Who was it that made the Iron Man game right before the movie even came out? There was Sega.
Oh yeah, the open world.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah. And they were, you know, and Favreau was like telling them this is a piece of military hardware and it has to move and has to have weight and has to move like a machine. Mm-hmm. And the game was terrible, but I feel like this encapsulates that. Right, you get in that javelin thing and it moves like a military machine and it has weight. And learning to, I actually had the experience of learning to control it and learn to fly with it. And I was like watching myself do this on the screen. I'm like, oh, it's like Iron Man. Like, oh, and then it sank in, right? It's like, oh shit. There's an undercurrent of world building and story there that the demo didn't really get into. You'd run into places or you'd try to talk to people and go, this content is not available in the demo. It's like, well, good. Then why'd you leave that guy there? But you can, but like, just knowing that it's there, you start to feel that, oh, there's threads here. This is a BioWare game. Right. Mm, there is a world here and there will be people and stories and quests, and the quests themselves in the demo. I didn't get to finish all of them because, you know, the game frequently did not actually work for me. But they were interesting and the characters were interesting and the scenarios were interesting.
Why were they interesting? What was interesting about the quests?
It was not so because it wasn't Destiny, I guess. I don't know. Right. It's like it didn't have that feel of like we've built this. A really great core 29-second loop, and now we have to slam a game together around it, right?
Sure.
It's like classic BioWare, we've built this world.
There's a person asking you to do something, then they have person desires.
They have their characters, yeah, they have motivations, they have inner lives, right? And you as an avatar, at least as far as the demo goes, the voice, right? The voice behind the first-person avatar that you're playing as, boring as hell. And you've got, you know, the party chat of all the advisors talking in your helmet, telling you what to do. Very clearly designed specifically to be played with a group, which I didn't do. And I don't feel that my experience suffered from it.
See, now I think that's important because I think a huge portion of the audience, you know, well, if we consider the audience that knows Anthem exists as a whole, I think that there's a significant portion of that audience that knows it exists that wants to play it by themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just can't imagine playing a BioWare game multiplayer. It just, there's so many side quests and just like, it, like, are you romancing as a group? I mean, I just, that's such a...
Yeah, that sounds not good.
I mean, I guess you...
That's
you could,
the zeitgeist, you know, yeah, man.
But I mean, that's just always been one of the big things for a BioWare game for me. And it's like, is that really something we're gonna do? Is it like a team shooter?
Sorry.
Yeah,
that's
know.
What the raids are, Sam.
Yeah,
oh, it's just like a group date. Singles mixer.
There was one part of one mission where I had to clear out some bad guys, and the actual shooting and traversal is very cool. It's unique, in fact. It's not Destiny. You can see the hand of EA sort of shoved up the butt of the BioWare puppet, right? Making it say the "We Are Destiny" things. But underneath all that, the game does not want to be Destiny. Except that it makes you, you know, it really makes you feel like you have to play it with multiple people. Like, at the end of one of the missions, I had to clear out a bunch of dudes, and they just kept coming, right?
Mm.
And it was very clearly designed to be, like, there's one massive guy you have to kill, and if you kill that guy, all the baddies stop spawning. But meanwhile, the baddies are attacking you, and they're attacking you in very interesting ways, and it's very cool to play. So, like, as one person, you can't really focus on killing the bad guy, because there's all the other guys. So, like, if I had a couple other dudes helping me out, yeah, that mission would have been way easier. I finally did it, but it took me forever.
This is like, not to go all Gaius Baltar on you, but this has all happened before and it will happen again. If the year right now were 2010, everything you just said could be applied to Star Wars The Old Republic.
Oof.
Wherein it's broken as shit, you're struggling to even make it work, you can feel the EA hand up the butt of BioWare making it say all of the... you know, zeitgeisty corporate mandate things, replace Destiny with World of Warcraft. But beneath it is an incredibly interesting, rich game full of really cool quests that you want to know more about because you're connecting on a human level, and a really interesting set of mechanics that you really want to continue engaging in. But you're also like, man, I really wish I could do this by myself, and it's really not going to let me.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is Old Republic eventually turned into a good game after 6 years.
Yeah, and then they pulled the plug. So that's the real question, right? Are enough people going to have enough of an experience to keep this game that demands many, many, many people play it?
Are people talking about it? The only people I see talking about Anthem are games journalists dreading having to play it out of obligation.
I mean, also, I've been getting the BioWare fans that are like, oh, please work, I'll never get Dragon Age again if this doesn't work.
To be fair, yeah, there's a bit of an echo chamber effect there. There were enough people attempting to play the VIP demo to crash whatever, you know, shoestring system was making it all happen, which BioWare swears was not servers. It was not directly tied to server load. It was more specifically how the network handled interfacing with all the different systems and hardwares that people had in their houses, right? Which is still the same problem. Yeah. It's just not, you know, it's not that they didn't plan for the server load, which is what they were wanting to not be dinged on, which makes no sense. Still, at the end of the day, they weren't prepared for that many people trying to play the demo simultaneously. Oh, and also the game was broken, right?
Right. Right.
So VIP experience all the way around. I feel like I got my $70 worth.
Oh, that's how many space bucks you gave this game?
I think I did. I don't remember. It's like 60 or 70. I may have done the special get a special armor thing because I'm a sucker for that.
Yeah, it gives you tchotchkes.
Yeah, I like tchotchkes.
You know, Bob, I my experience so far has been yours. I haven't seen a whole lot of chatter about this game from regular human beings. And yes, I am implying that people who are like very deeply entrenched in the video game industry, both professionally or as a hobby, whatever. Yes, I am saying you're not normal human beings. Nobody on this show is a normal human being. Nobody listening to this show is a normal human being.
Nope.
But at the exact same time, I feel like Anthem may fall into that category of games like, say, Grand Theft Auto Online or Fallout 4. Where in that very highly specified video game world isn't paying attention in the same way that the massive audience that is going to be playing it is. But I can't tell.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you could sit there and you could go to an Amazon and see Fallout 4 racking up like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pre-orders and being at the top of the product list. You're not seeing that happen with Anthem. So it is kind of a mystery if there is sort of a groundswell in interest. I mean, there is obviously space for Anthem to exist right now because no one's playing Destiny 2 right now. Destiny 2 is Destiny 2 is New Coke in the land of video games.
Yeah.
And I think that if it like gets good reviews and good, you know, once it actually hits, there might be, because I think just there's a lot of skepticism about it. And I think that's probably why you're not getting these pre-orders.
Yeah. And well-earned skepticism, because at the end of the day, the Star Wars Battlefront 2 fiasco and the entire loot box disaster with that game at the end of 2017, that wasn't a just video game people fiasco. That was a real world public, the millions upon millions of people buying video games public reacted so poorly to that. And they're not stupid. Like that audience isn't dumb. And you can see that skepticism of a massive multiplayer EA product with the fact that Battlefield 5 really didn't turn the needle this past fall. And Battlefield is typically huge.
Yeah.
So I think that people are looking at Anthem and thinking to themselves, this is the type of game I like. I like Destiny, or I liked Mass Effect in the long, long ago. And I think that, like you said, Sam, they're probably just sitting there saying, this is a wait and see situation. But hell, if it's a wait and see situation, this is the kind of thing that could die on the vine.
Well, that's the thing. You have to get a sufficient amount of hype for this kind of thing. And you can see the hand of marketing here, right? You know, this is what they're going for with this demo rollout, a sort of tiered rollout. There's a joke on Twitter now about the different ways that you can play Anthem. It's this chart that EA put out, and it's this ridiculously labyrinthine, arcane chart of like the different ways, different amounts of money you can spend to play different parts of the game at different times. It's like, and I actually joked about it on Twitter last night, and Narando came at me and said, "Well, this is what they've done for all of their games this cycle." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, you mean all the games that aren't working for them? Okay, maybe there's a pattern here." BioWare, for its to its credit, is trying very hard. But let me read you from the note that was put out by their head of live service over the weekend. During the demo, while things were broken, and while they admitted there were problems experienced by some players that they could potentially fix, but that they were client issues, so they didn't want to ruin the experience for everyone to fix this part of the experience for some, right? Which on the one hand, I get. On the other hand, that's exactly the problem with games as service. Mm-hmm. You are not only trusting that the money you're spending on this product is going to be returned in the form of a good product, you're also paying for this sort of nebulous business sense customer service mind that you have no idea what the decision-making process is. You have no idea if they're going to even honor, you know, the money you've spent. You know, I spent money to play this demo. I was having problems with it. And I was being told that the problems I was having weren't going to be solved because they didn't want to make the experience worse for other users, right? So I'm being told by the people I gave money to that I'm being triaged, right? Basically, yeah. Right?
Sure.
So but let me read you from this statement that he goes to list all the problems they're having, all the things that they're trying to solve. And they've since released another statement after this talking about how things are going to be different this weekend. Towards the end of the statement, though, he says, "While we have had problems, we have also had many players enjoying the game. It's been incredibly humbling to see so many people watching along with us on Twitch. Over 300,000 concurrent viewers yesterday and over 100 million minutes watched. These are Fortnite-type numbers," he says. "Thank you for your support."
Dear investors, I mean fans, these are Fortnite numbers.
Wait, this is amazing. It's like, I'm sorry that you're having a bad time. Maybe you should go watch it on Twitch.
Maybe you should go watch some of these actual VIPs whose experiences we are taking seriously. But nowhere in this statement does he say how many people are actually playing the game, right? They're talking about how many people are watching other people play it on Twitch, I'm not poo-pooing that. I mean, that's a huge part of the industry right now. But they don't say how popular it is. They don't say how many people are willingly playing this. They're just pointing to the VIPs who are... I don't know. Are they playing a different build of the game than I was? I don't even know.
Who is that statement talking to, Russ? Who is meant to read that and feel any level
like they're investors?
Of interest? Or yeah, that is the most investor forward statement delivered to fans that I have ever heard in my goddamn life. Like, just the statement, "These are Fortnite numbers."
No. Like, it's almost as if they were like putting it out there with the assumption that anything they said to fans would wind up on the internet, and that they just want to, like, they don't really care about the fans and just want to bypass that for any of like articles about how badly this demo went.
Well, the fact that they decided not to push a fix for the infinite load problem during the demo because it would impact the experience of some of the VIPs tells you they don't care about the fans. They care about the people watching the actual VIPs on Twitch. And, you know, I thought I could pay for the VIP upgrade since the black panel van didn't show up at my house with a white gloved EA representative handing me my invitation. But apparently I wasn't even able with $70 to be considered a VIP.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's maybe the issue, though, is like you've already paid your dues. And what they're really hoping for is like the buzz that this is going to generate on Twitch.
Well, good luck with that. So that was the VIP Anthem experience. More on that this weekend, and I'll let you know.
as Russ dives in there. Yeah, Bob.
I cannot fathom like the amount that it must be costing them to launch. I mean, it's Destiny like, but it's not like a Destiny game, right? This is a new IP thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And,
Very
and
much.
there's this much money shoved into this, and I'm serious when I say, now granted, it's not like I'm in game stores every goddamn day. I'm, you know, sure. So it's there, but like it, I can't imagine anyone spending any amount of money of this size on anything that's not like an existing IP, because my honest sense of the entire video games market right now, outside of people who write about them for a living, is that the video games industry is legacy franchises that existed up to about 8 years ago, and Fortnite and Overwatch, and absolutely nothing else.
Yeah. So this is interesting, Bob, because in the past week, I have, and again, this is a unique scenario for me. It just happened to have taken place. But in the past 10 days, I have been inside of both a mom and pop video game store. And it's not like a mom and pop store that happens to have a few video games to make ends meet. That is a video game store. And I have also been inside of a GameStop. And what is interesting about both at this exact moment is if you walk into both the mom and pop store and GameStop, the overwhelming, you know, expression of what both the market itself and what the fans want are the same. So you walk into both, and it's all advertisements and posters and displays for Kingdom Hearts, for Resident Evil, and for Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
Those are the things that you see when you walk into those stores. The only sign that Anthem exists at all is in the lower left-hand corner at the GameStop near me. There is a little, like, poster in the window. But it is dwarfed even by a poster for Call of Duty Black Ops 4. Is that what it's called? Is it 4 or is it like hatch mark, hatch mark, hatch mark, hatch mark? Do you have to say them all?
No, there's a V in there if it's actually 4. It's like Blops IV.
Blops IVV.
Just put the blops right in your bloodstream. Just
give me the blops, all right? I want the intravenous blops. To your point, there is not a, for what is a new IP from a massively recognized storied studio from what is still ostensibly the biggest publisher on the face of the planet, not a whole lot of juice behind it, which I think also everything that we're talking about right now, it sort of ties in to a video that you ran on Escapist just this past day, latest entry in the Game Overthinkers series. Called Nonstop, that is, you know, on the surface about GameStop's future, but sort of about the future of video game retail and the future of how people find out about things like Anthem.
GameStop basically has been trying to sell themselves to someone because this, I have no idea how anyone makes any money in media anymore. I really don't. Because, like, half of my day is seeing how much...
Bob, no! Cut!
Don't let them find out! They're on to us!
Dude, I go to Netflix screenings of things and see how Netflix sets you. And I find out Netflix doesn't have any... Like, two stories will be side by side in my browser. Netflix does not actually have any money. Netflix is going to spend $1 billion making a sequel to The Dark Crystal. Okay, I'd love to see what the algorithm is that told them that was a thing. I'm glad they're doing it, but I don't know who told them they should. But, so GameStop, which I think a year ago bought ThinkGeek, which is pretty much just GameStop without games.
Recently. They recently bought ThinkGeek, and I think they sold Kongregate. Kongregate spun off finally.
And they bought Micromania, which is like the British GameStop, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... We're going to find out that this is actually like the MCP, like making purchases. This is it, like it actually happened and no one told anyone. But so GameStop has been trying to sell itself to a buyer for like 2 years. And yesterday dropped the news and said, so we are literally the only retailer the only specialty retailer that exists for this product, which is a giant, allegedly profitable business. no one wants to buy us. So we're going to give up.
With an international footprint, too. GameStop is not just in the United States. They are an international company. They're present.
This is not like there's six other stores that do this. This is literally, like, the last time a company did this, it was called Blockbuster. Ask your grandfather.
No, ask Captain Marvel. Captain Marvel is going to go to a Blockbuster.
Ask me. I worked at Blockbuster in college.
So did I.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I worked there in high school and college. I worked there for a long time.
I think somehow we all knew that, Bob. That just makes sense. That's the Bob origin story.
Right? I worked for Blockbuster. I worked for Sam Goody. I worked for Suncoast. At least two of you sign off on my paycheck, so I'm just going to stop naming places that I've worked that then closed. So.
Yeah, that's not funny at all. No.
You and me both, dude. You and me both.
Yeah, seriously. I've got a litany of those. One of the publications I worked for, Unbound Worlds, just closed yesterday.
Ooh. Oh, so no shit.
That's just the life of being in media.
Yeah.
Bob, the thing that is fascinating about all of this and what I find so compelling about your video is the fact that the closure of GameStop is relevant beyond the fact that it's just, oh, well, games retail is apparently not a viable business to other people, even though it very clearly is. You know, last year, one of the most interesting things I heard from any gaming executive was Andrew House was giving a talk just before E3. And Andrew House, no longer with Sony, but in a lot of ways, he is the person that defined PlayStation's presence from, you know, the end of the PlayStation 2 era through to the PlayStation 4's success. Andrew House sort of spearheaded the vision of, here is how we're going to make a gaming platform work in the age when everybody thinks that consoles are going to die.
Mm.
And he sat on stage and he said, anybody that says that retail sales for individual games are not significant and will, you know, not still be significant for at least 5 to 10 years, they're a fool, because the stark reality is that you take the United States, which is still the largest game purchasing market on the face of the planet. We're still bigger than China. We're still bigger than, you know, most of Western Europe.
Huge.
There is a huge, yeah, enormous swath of the United States that does not have access to reliable high-speed internet. Digital sales do not serve millions and millions of people in the U.S. alone. And that's not even talking about markets like Brazil, India, all of these places that are growing their access to high-speed internet and have a significantly sized audience for video games, but they don't have that access either. These are people who buy video games in stores and are going to continue to for a while, even as we transition into cloud services like what Microsoft is doing. But all of that aside, the loss of GameStop, as you point out, is more than just an impact to the business and how we sell video games. It speaks to a loss in the culture itself.
Yeah, it's a community thing. And, you know, I recognize that, look, I'm going to be 37 in like 20 days. I recognize that this is, you know, like in a old before your time rant thing, because that's kind of the show, but not this show, my show. I buy stuff digitally. I do. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it. I have a certain amount of paranoia about like cloud saves and stuff. I don't like them because in my head, I'm thinking this will be erased. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't just mean like this will like get deleted someday. I'm still in the mindset of, if I put this near a refrigerator magnet, I might not get it back. You know, I prefer to own as much stuff physical as possible. It's just how I do it. But it's a sense of the community atmosphere, the fact that you have to go to a place and pick something up, and it's little things that come along with it. And I know it's impossible to test and prove for this, and I know that I am I'm a big fat white guy, so I'm a literal walking pile of social privilege. So I recognize that the world, if I'm thinking about, oh, you know, things were better before and now they suck, that it's very possible that I'm just having like negative things shoved in my face and was able to not see them before. My sense is that it's cannot be an accident that the games culture developed its current reputation for being a giant toxic sinkhole, even amid the rest of, you know, nerd media. Mm. You know, like next to Star Wars fandom, there is still like a wall of pikes up, like around games culture that still says, hey, you don't want to go over there. I mean, it's all of it, man.
And you think a lot of that toxicity has to come from some of the social isolation that comes with gaming?
You know, I think so. I don't think that it's necessary. Because look, I'm not a guy who goes and hangs out. I was an indoor kid myself, I don't necessarily think that's there. I think that. So I'm not one of these people that says, oh, if you don't spend every waking moment outside, you know, hanging out with, you know, a big group of people, that means you're socially broken or something. But I think that in terms of like a basic, you know, manners and learning how to interact with people, it can't be an accident that it is so much less a part of the lifestyle now to occasionally go and, you know, say, may I purchase this? Yes, please. Thank you. On a regular basis, just to buy the damn game as opposed to repeatedly ramming your finger into a button until it gives you what you want. And now people don't know how to act with one another.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to check your privilege there because, as you say, the game store experience is not the same for everyone. And I've had the experience of walking into stores and being questioned for, you know, what it is I'm buying or kind of being ogled by people at checkout. And for me, as a result, you know, buying online is a pleasure.
Exactly.
You know, and I've had good experiences at game stores where like I've met people and played with them for the first time. But you know, a lot of times those are the exact spaces you would think that they would be.
Yeah. I mean, the real hope is I hear exactly what you're saying, Bob. And I think that, you know, when, again, as a walking pile of privilege myself, the place where I see the benefits of a very strong physical component to, you know, the video game culture is when you go to a place like PAX and you see a generally overwhelming positive vibe, right? People relate to each other, people are having a good time, people are good, and you don't see en masse, you know, manifestations of some of the toxicity you see online. That said, you know, everything you experience in a game store, Sam, still exists in those places. You know, I think that my hope, at least, is that we are entering a moment where I think that, say GameStop does vanish, I think that there may be more of an opportunity for small, modest mom-and-pop stores to reemerge in the same way that you've seen with record stores over the past 10 years at this point. And I think that the record store of 2019 is a far more welcoming and inclusive place than the record store of, say, 2000. You know, because I think almost with all media that inspires fervent, diehard fandom, you know, you see a lot of the spaces for those places, whether they're retail or otherwise, dominated by gatekeeping white dudes. Sam, is that fair? Is that fair to say that, like?
Oh, I mean, that's fair.
Yeah, like record stores, comic shops, bookstores, what have you, and
podcasts.
Podcasts. You know, anecdotal experience. Obviously, I'm not sitting here with a huge spreadsheet and data to back this up. My experience now, though, is you go to a record store, and if they have a viable business that is able to survive at this point, it's because they're bringing in a very devoted small audience that is mixed gender, mixed race, and, you know, that's the community that is going to survive. The mom and pop game shop that I have visited recently has that vibe. It is a place, you know, it's mixed gender in terms of staffing, and it's a very, very welcoming place. It's not the kind of place that you can walk into like you would yesterday and find like Tracer's butt from Overwatch just like mounted on the ceiling and staring you in the face. So I think that that's the hope, at least. And I, you know, at the end of the day, you talk about this in your video as well, Bob. Even if physical video games themselves, cartridges, discs, what have you, totally vanish from the landscape, there is still going to be the ephemera that surrounds them.
Yeah. You know, the thing is, like, I have no doubt that, you know, if and when you have, like, the end of the whatever you, I don't know what the retail speak name for what GameStop calls itself now, you know, that the artisanal boutique thing steps in to replace, you know, Tower Records goes away and, you know, basically the Portland version of that steps in and becomes the new thing. That's fine. That's a different thing than, you know, just the game store that's there. You know, it's kind of like McDonald's takes a lot of shit as they can be, which they should. They're bad, you know, bad for the environment, clear cutting rainforest, feed cattle, all of the bad stuff McDonald's does, et cetera. It's not that kind of podcast, I assume.
It's always ready to turn into that type of podcast.
Cut! Cut!
But, you know, one of the things that they often turn into, like the reason that their breakfast thing is such a big thing is because the whole idea of the place that you go to get coffee, like the local diner thing, is still a needed thing that basically doesn't exist in a lot of city spaces anymore for seniors, lower income people, whatnot, to just go and just hang out and drink their goddamn hot liquid in the morning.
Sure.
You know, if McDonald's wasn't there to fill that in, Starbucks doesn't replace that. You know, it doesn't. And I don't.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
You know, I'm sure that the curated for fans of the quintessential video game experience game store. Good. Glad to have it. I'm sure it'll be a thing. The place where just the kid can wander in off the street to buy Pokemon cards and also walk out and say, oh, hey, here's this thing I've never heard of, and now it's a new experience or whatnot. Like the happy medium in between, you know, the standing museum of games culture and the section at Best Buy, the basically the middle class version, like everything else in this country, the hollowing out of the middle class thing of this is where you eventually wind up in a problem. And I didn't touch on that aspect of it in the video just because I have touched on it so repeatedly in the other ones and I can't constantly be a broken record on it or people will stop watching the show.
Yeah. But I'll back you up on that, Bob, because I've been doing a lot of filming at a lot of cities and we shot some really cool retro game stores in Los Angeles and Toronto. But there's a lot of people who don't live in Los Angeles or Toronto or Portland or San Francisco who live in middle America and, you know, not even middle class, but, you know, decidedly lower class folks who live in small communities who don't have the fast internet where they can really download everything they buy. What happens, you know, where GameStop has conglomerated every possible option into its, you know, homunculus at this point. And what happens if that homunculus goes away? Where do these people buy games and get that part of the experience? Whether it's always a good experience or not, I think is a separate issue. If it entirely goes away, what replaces it? And I don't know what the answer is either.
One of the things that GameStop is facing is just it's part of the death of malls in general. And, you know, it's just, I think everyone wants to be out of the mall business. And I think one of the things that could come out of it is the malls that are surviving, they're building in some more experiential things like, you know, big movie theaters and yoga studios. And, you know, I've been seeing a resurgence actually in like video game bars or like kind of like basically places to have your LAN parties for, you know, back in the day. And so I think places that are offering that kind of like, again, this isn't the middle class gaming store, but it's like the kind of luxe video game experience could produce that, at least that social dynamic you're talking about, Bob, as a replacement for that, as a place for people to audition games. It's not a replacement for the physical store, but it is something that I think could grow and change with the hobby.
My worry is that it's the comic book store thing. Is like a like a 21st century version of that, because they, like, I grew up with comic book stores, but like they turned out to not be a great thing for that business. You know, they left the magazine racks, and it became even more a dungeoned, closed off hobby for a specific type and sect of audience that was able to gatekeep in its own way and push even more people out and cultivate. It's going to be only this one type of book that gets done for this one type of audience. And, you know, they literally, the medium has, in order to progress forward, comics themselves have basically had to die as a medium. And all of the characters and franchises have had to migrate. I'm talking about the big two, Marvel, DC, etc., have had to migrate off to television and film to grow any of their stuff into like a new audience, and then filter back in so that the books can get so low selling that they can afford to experiment and do anything for like an audience outside of my pasty ass.
I don't know. I mean, like that. I've got a disagreement there, and that, like, I mean, maybe it's because I live in a college town of Evanston, but like, we've got a comic book store here, Comics Revolution, that has been wonderful. It's existed since I've been here, and you know, it's an independent comic book store, but they do their free comic book day, and you know, it's the wonderful, inclusive, nerd-dumb place that we kind of dream about in terms of like, they've got, you know, they've got the big two very prominently displayed, but they also have all your indie stuff and knowledgeable people behind the counter that will recommend it. So and that's been true for, oh God, how long have I been here? 15 years. So I don't think that like the state of comic books is necessarily as dire as you're painting it. It's there is a high level of variance. You know, like I said, I've been to gaming stores that are wonderful. I've been to gaming stores that are terrible. And they think there's a reason there's no giant comic book chain the way there is with GameStop, is that it requires that kind of special fine touch to succeed in that way.
Like wine buyers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think I found on Twitter an interesting cap to this discussion. Y'all know Gary Whitta, former video game journalist, current screenwriter, working on Star Wars and something else. Oh, he's doing the last Starfighter remake currently. Tweeted
don't
just
play
yesterday.
With my emotions, Gary.
well, I trust Gary. I have faith in Gary. Tweeted just yesterday. Recently, I had a fascinating and frankly alarming chat with some local comic book store owners about just how hard it is out there for retailers right now. Bottom line, all caps, support your local comic store. If you don't, you might pass by one morning and find it's no longer there.
I was actually just going to say, Sam, you talking about having an independent comic book store that has survived for the past 15 years. And Bob, you talking about old men having a place where they can go and drink hot liquid in the morning. That 15 years encapsulates the manga boom and the manga crash.
Nice.
And during that whole period, there was a beautiful old man trying to find a place to drink his hot, weird anime liquid in the morning. And old Jim Cameron has finally lived his billionaire dream of getting a manga adaptation on the screen.
Rock star segue.
Look at that
rock
shit!
Rock star segue.
That is it! If segues was an Olympic sport, I could segue for the United States of America.
Let me turn on an amp so I can give you just a guitar chord on it. Just a power chord on that.
Open ease for days, Russ. Sam, you saw Battle Angel Alita, a freaking movie that Jim Cameron, the producer of this movie, has been trying to get made, and I think Bob can back me up on this, since 1997?
At least!
And now it exists. He and Robert Rodriguez got it on the screen, and freaking Inglourious Bastards guy is there wearing a trench coat. There's a lady with eyes that are crazy, and it's a movie. It's a real movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is. So, I saw it last night. It is stunning. I saw it in 3D and can't recommend that enough. The fight scenes, the action sequences are so much fun. And then plot-wise, it's a huge disappointment. So, but yeah, if you're not familiar, the basic deal is that this is, you know, this kind of post-apocalyptic cyberpunk world where there used to be all these great floating cities across Earth, and now all but one of them has fallen. And from like the super subtle social commentary textbook that brought us Elysium, everyone wants to be in the floating city, but is stuck on ground living off the floating city's scraps. Mm. Christoph Waltz is this like awesome, nice doctor wearing a sweet trench coat and finds this cyborg girl in a trash heap and decides to adopt her, names her Alita, and surprise, surprise, she's secretly a amazing combat badass.
Now, I want to forgive what seems like an endless pile of ridiculous tropes in this movie. And we'll forgive it by the fact that this movie preceded a lot, material preceded a lot of these ridiculous tropes. Like this is, Battle Angel Alita was once upon a time your inevitable grimy punk rock evolution of the sweet Beatles goodness that was Astro Boy in the 1960s. The comic is, you know, the 80s-est response to established manga tropes that you could possibly have. And that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. And it probably would have felt a lot more forward-thinking and relevant had this movie been made when it went into production a billion years ago.
Had it been made before Joss Whedon in the 90s turned it into literally everything he did.
Yes, yeah, literally for sure. Everything. Or if the Wachowskis hadn't ever, like, if Jim Cameron had beaten the Wachowskis to even, like, when they released Bound, this would have felt more relevant. Like, forget the fucking Matrix. Just beat Bound and its visual, like, you know, language and aesthetic.
I mean, it's kind of fun because it's a version of cyberpunk that actually eschews all, like, hacking.
Yeah.
Instead, it's like, we're just, like, cyborgs and space battles. That's what we got. And, you know, I love that. I'm there for that. But it's just got the most cliched YA romance at the heart of this, which is like, you know, Alita falls for like scrappy guy who's got like shady dealings but a heart of gold, and he's just like, I want to give my magical heart to you and help you fulfill your dream to get to the city in the sky, and I'll do this by playing rollerball, which is like Quidditch mixed with Death Race. And it's just, the plot is so bad. And, like, the acting is so bad. Like, Mahershala Ali plays a bad guy. And it's just, like, that guy can do, like, almost no wrong for me. And he's fine. Like, but, and, like, that's just the best that can be said of, like, any of the performances in this movie.
Sam, can you put yourself, this is hard, and it's hard for anyone. But can you put yourself into, like, not even 13-year-old, can you put yourself in 10-year-old brain? Can you put yourself in the weird brain of, for all everyone on this podcast, it would have been like, oh shit, Gilbert Gottfried, Up All Night is happening. What the hell is this big eye girl robot anime movie? Now, imagine the 9 or 10 year old that's like, what do you got for me, Netflix algorithm? What are they going to think when they encounter this? Is it going to grip them?
I think it'll grip them. I mean, like, it's a movie that I think 14-year-olds are going to love. Like, and the fight scenes, like I said, they're incredible. It's like, you know, these super cyborged up people with, like, scythes and, like, spiraling chains, and they're just eviscerating each other, which they can get away with because they're all just cyborgs, so even though it's PG-13, it's just, like, metal bits falling off. And, like, there's cool, like, zero-G training sequences. I think my biggest problem with it overall is that it's actually not a standalone movie. It is just like a lot of buildup for a sequel.
Oh, that sucks. That sucks. I hate that.
And so, like, it just feels like all this YA and all this like motorball is just this like padding in there to make this sequel that will actually give us like the meat of like what's going on in this weird sci-fi world that I'm like very interested in. Mm-hmm. But like, I am not interested in Alita and Hugo go on a date and Hugo's like, oh, your favorite food can't be oranges. It's got to be chocolate. I'm like, that's the most cliche thing I have ever heard and is terrible. And she's like, oh, my favorite food now is chocolate. And so like that, it just like, there's just, I the goodwill that watching a guy with like four cyborg dogs like lunge on like a giant hulking monster with like finger chains, like that buys a lot of goodwill from me. But the that like that chocolate is just, it's just like, oh God, come on.
It's like Vertigo, the anime, you know? Ooh, yeah. Wear this outfit. Oh, and spit. Oh, now you look just like her. I want to look just like her. I want you to look just like her. I really do want to look just like her.
Creepy, you know, and terrible.
This begs the question, guys. And like, I don't want to get into the whole idea of, were they ever good in the first place? Or did they have really good editors? But let's just ask the question of, are Robert Rodriguez and James Cameron capable of producing something in the 21st century that is worth watching?
That's a really good question.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to go no. Listen, I'm not necessarily a Cameron fan. I mean, who didn't like Aliens back when Aliens came out? And it's still a fine film.
But a remarkable human being that was his ex-wife edited Aliens. And if you watch the version of that he wanted to release, it's a hot pile of garbage.
Yeah, it's garbage. Rodriguez did good stuff. I mean, Desperado and the film that preceded it, the indie film that preceded it, good stuff. He's done some good stuff since. Some of his collabs with Tarantino really highlighted how much of a hack Tarantino is. And so I have him, I have to thank him for that. You know, he's focused on like Spy Kids and stuff, and I can't fault him for that. Dude has kids. Life changes.
All right, wait. Was Spy Kids in the 21st century? I thought Spy Kids 1 was like 1998, 99.
Yeah, Spy Kids 1 was pre 21st, I think.
So what has he done in the 21st century?
He's on Sin City.
Machete.
Sin City.
Death Proof and the Grindhouse collaborations.
Death Proof was fine. You know, Machete was Machete. I mean, Machete just has to be Machete. It's funny just because it is, right? Like, it was never going to be a good film. It started life as like a 20-second joke in one of his other films. How do you make a good film out of that?
I think he did.
Yeah, Bob thinks he did. There you go. Boom, I win this argument.
I mean, Cameron and Rodriguez are vastly different filmmakers from one another. You know, I mean, I don't think Avatar is a bad movie. I think it's probably the weakest narrative feature that Cameron had. Well, oh no, True Lies is the weakest narrative.
Mm. Wait a second, you're saying that True Lies is a narrative and plot masterpiece that doesn't offend anyone?
Well, see, that's the problem, is that like True Lies is actually a really, really well-structured, very funny screenplay. It's just a really, really well-structured, funny screenplay that you would never release today for very good reason.
Very good reason.
It's like True Lies is the quintessential movie that comes out. It's like, wow, I really should have thought about how awful everything about this premise is. Wow, I'm sorry, every woman I know, about not recognizing that the middle part of this movie is just the worst thing ever. But, you know, it's a well-written version of the worst thing ever, but it's gross.
All right, here's the only thing that remains good about True Lies to this day. Only one thing. And it's that Paxton. That Paxton is so good in True Lies. Everything else is very lamentable.
Cameron is a rock solid filmmaker. I don't think he has, other than True Lies being disgusting, I don't think he has an actual bad movie.
I think Avatar is one of the best uses of CGI to date. Or 3D. Mm. Like, I remember seeing that in 3D and being like, oh, I understand why this technology is impressive now. Like, just like the like holographic photos that people have and like how it moves in the 3D. Amazing. Do I think that it needs like three sequels? No. But, you know, it's a fun movie. Mm. I'd say Alita it's a fun, bad movie.
A fun, bad movie.
Hmm. It's much more a Rodriguez movie, I think. It feels more like a Robert Rodriguez movie than a James Cameron. But it technically more of a James Cameron movie, because it's like you can feel a second take being done a few times. Much love to Robert Rodriguez, but like he just knocks stuff out and just gets it done because he likes to experiment.
Bob, you reviewed last week for Escapist The Kid Who Would Be King.
I did.
Which was not on my radar at all. And, Sam, I was just asking you about the fact, is a 14-year-old going to love Battle Angel Alita? And it like it's interesting to me that there are these movies that don't feel like Battle Angel Alita and The Kid Who Would Be King feel like an old style of, you know, movie made for children. And like young adults rather. And that they aren't beholden to an attempt to make something that is like seven movies long and sell a bunch of merch in addition to that. Although it does sound like Alita might have a little bit of that based on what you said, Sam.
Do you
think, Bob, that like you saw Kid Who Would Be King and immediately said, this is the kind of flick that makes film nerds out of seventh graders. Does Alita have any of that for you? Did you see any of that there?
I don't think it's going to make a film nerd out of anyone. Yeah. Like, it's like just the way I don't think Avatar will make a film nerd out of anyone. You know, it's got some cool fight scenes. It's got like a very cool cyberpunk world. It might make some people be like, oh, I'm interested in cyberpunk now. But I don't think anyone's going to watch this and be like, this is my seminal film.
Mm-hmm. What took me a little while to kind of cue in on is like, okay, what is the energy? Because like the trailers for Alita are kind of selling it like it's aimed at, you know, like basically a Blade Runner type audience, just with a young character. And then I see the movie and, you know, half of it is, you know, Blade Runner, Elysium sort of thing going. And then the other half of it is the main character doing like this Iron Giant thing, but it's all about, ooh, boy, chocolate roller skates. And so it's, you know, a 72-year-old man trying to imagine what he thinks a 14-year-old girl thinks. And so like, and I'm not exaggerating, like the three sort of like signifiers of like, you know, transforming from murder bot to human are cute boy, I like chocolate, I enjoy roller skates are
yep,
like,
no, that's quite the assessment.
Oh,
and it's such a weird contrast too. Like there's like literally a scene where she's like almost ripped apart by this, you know, giant cyborg monster and like has this like near death experience and has to be stitched back into like a new like battle hardened body that will make her like the most deadly killing machine on Earth. And the next thing we see is her like going to like putting on some pads for an audition for Rollerball so that she can like impress her boyfriend.
It has kind of like a 12 act structure. Like if I didn't know that this is essentially just James Cameron transcribing, like, I assume multiple editions of a manga, each one with a 3 act structure of its own into a certain number of scenes of a movie, you'd know, because it just kind of has that structure to it. So one, I kind of had the same feeling that I had coming out of Jupiter Ascending. This is a better movie than Jupiter Ascending, I think.
No movie is better than Jupiter Ascending.
I think you mean every movie.
Ascending is the pinnacle of cinematic achievement, and Eddie Redmayne's performance in it is the great, it's the performance by which all others must be measured for the rest of time.
I felt qualified to say that The Kid Who Would Be King is a movie that like 12-year-old boys will watch and go, yes, I think this is the best thing I've ever seen because I've been there. So like Alita is trying really, really hard to be a YA cyberpunk movie for young girls. I feel unqualified to say whether or not it connects there. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was a 14-year-old girl at some point. I probably would have loved this movie then, but then also been like, this guy's so lame.
Yeah, you would have thought it was really embarrassing like a year later.
Yeah, well, I would have been like, no, because I think at the time I'd be like, yeah, Alita kicks ass. I wish she had a better boyfriend.
He is kind of the worst. I mean, it's sort of part of the movie that he's the worst, but he is kind of the worst.
He's just like so generic.
Everything that you guys have described has now given me a vision of what is my dream movie, which is the exact same movie, the exact same script, the exact same everything, except Alita is replaced by Rutger Hauer's character in Blade Runner. It has to be Roy Beatty.
Like, yeah, there we go.
Roy Beatty, like, looking moon-eyed at some teen heartthrob and being like, chocolate is my favorite food now.
Ooh, roller skates.
I saw the Tannhauser Nebula.
Yes. Yeah, that's my dream. That is my dream. Everybody, we're running hot
we're running
on time
out.
Today.
Thank you, Prime Minister.
Yeah. I will say. Yeah.
Just let me know when it's time to do my figurehead thing.
Run the state. Here we go.
Summon my chambers.
We are going to put to a vote. No. No, what I was going to say was we're running a little long. Next week, hopefully, it really depends on when this is going to run, but Sam is doing a Kingdom Hearts 3 review for Escapist.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's going to relate to. Hey, guys, I don't know if you knew, but Kingdom Hearts 3 review codes, it was a fucking fiasco. So,
oh, yeah.
Ta-da.
Yeah. And I'm going to write about that on probably the day after this podcast comes up, so stay tuned.
Keep an eye on that. Sam will be there. And I think we can segue our conversation about Kingdom Hearts into the next episode. Here's the only teaser I'm going to give you about Kingdom Hearts. If you don't want any spoilers, close your ears. But here's what I'm going to fucking say. This game's amazing. And if you really always dream about watching Woody from Toy Story, voiced by a Hanks, not the Hanks, but a Hanks. It's sub Hanks. But the game still's got Hanks. If you want to hear Woody have an existential breakdown when a 30-year-old man voicing a 16-year-old anime boy tells him that he's living in a falsely constructed reality, and Woody's like, oh shit, what? Let's say you're right, I am in a constructed reality. How would that make sense? And he's like, oh my god, Buzz, your laser works like a real laser. We're not on Earth anymore. How are we gonna find Andy? Nothing I just said is made up. All of that happens in the game. And then Woody beats the shit out of a sex doll. That game might say it's not a sex doll, but I'm telling you, that shit is wearing weird bunny ears and making eyes at Buzz Lightyear. This game is tight. Russ.
I remain firmly convinced that the only reason Disney keeps letting Square get away with making Kingdom Hearts is that if they said anything, they're worried people will find out that they let Square make Kingdom Hearts.
They'll notice. Somebody's gonna notice.
Not at all where I thought that capsule review was gonna go, but I think it's a good one to take us out on. Thank you for joining us for Escapist Podcast Volume 2. I'm your host, Russ. On behalf of Anthony, Sam, Bob, and our producer, Aurora, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Join us next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.